Welcome, everybody. I'm Ann Temkin, the Marie-José and Henry Kravis Chief Curator of Painting and Sculpture and Curator of the Gabriela Roscoe exhibition that opened here last week. I'm pleased to have here with us tonight, before he takes off literally for Mexico City tomorrow morning, the artist, Gabriela Roscoe, and Bryony Fair, one of the preeminent scholars on Roscoe's work, and in fact, the person who did an interview with him, a marvelous, rich, meaty interview with him for his last big museum show, which was a few years ago in Mexico City at the Bellas Artes. And Bryony and I have both written, of course, and worked closely with Gabrielle in recent years and going back some time. Bryony has also just recently, in fact, last week, curated the exhibition Eva Hess Studio Work, which opened at the Camden Arts Center in London, literally the night that Gabrielle's show opened here. So she's here tonight having the occasion to see for the first time the exhibition and having written on the notebooks for our catalog has a lot to say about the work. And she and I are going to together question each other, question Gabrielle, about really what the experience of making a retrospective at this point, 47 years old, really what the effect of that is on one's own thinking about one's work, and perhaps what effect it may have on the work to come. I have a few general announcements, the most important of which seems to be to let you all know that there will be a reception following our conversation, which will actually not be in this building, but in the Cullman building across the garden. So there will be people posted throughout the path from here through the sculpture garden to the Cullman building for everyone here to get there and have a glass of wine afterwards. That is sponsored by the Mexican Cultural Institute and the Mexican Tourism Board. So we're very grateful to them. I also want to say that we are going to do this as a very informal conversation at first among the three of us, but we definitely want to leave 10 to 15 minutes at the end for all of you to be participants in the conversation as well. So please get out your pencils and make notes of little questions or thoughts that occur to you as we are speaking. And finally, if anyone needs sign language interpretation, come to the front because we do have that available for you. And once we get into the audience discussion, we will have people going around with microphones. So please wait to ask your question or make your comment until you get a microphone so everybody will be able to hear it well. So with that, Gabrielle and Bryony, let's go up there and begin. We'll test our mics. Is this good from me? Yes?
Yes. Good.
Yes, yes. Hola.
Yes, yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Well, if I can start.
Well, okay.
If you'll allow. Well, what I want to say first is that I'm so pleased to be able to see this amazing show and only curating my own Hesse show last week, installing it would have kept me away, Gabrielle, but I also want to say that I could never have done that show had it not been for your work, because I guess the work has been most formative for me in thinking about how to reimagine how to deal with the art object. So maybe we could come back to something about that later, but I guess the most obvious and the first question that I want to address to you both is, you know, as you said, Anne, thinking about a retrospective at this point in your life, Gabrielle, is it the youngest artist who's had a mid-career retrospective? How do you go about conceiving of a show like this when Gabrielle, as an artist, is, I guess, best known for breaking down the coherence of things? And it's one thing to make your own shows and to make different kinds of shows. But a retrospective here is a slightly, you know, different ball game. And so I just wanted you to talk a little bit about how you can, you know, how you thought about it.
We worked closely together over the last 2 or 3 years, and I think really from the beginning there was no discussion or controversy between the two of us whatsoever. We were definitely not interested in some kind of pedagogical, sort of statistically representative sequence that might be the thought with perhaps a retrospective of somebody from 100 years ago. And instead, I think my hope was to approach it as with Gabrielle, as if Gabrielle was doing a show of new work, and have Gabrielle really take the lead in figuring out with me the installation, the checklist, the kind of reimagining of things in a new context, having neighbors that they never could have had because they were works 10 or 15 years apart, but not in any way feeling some kind of responsibility to a typical historical progression explanation of his work. It seems like that can wait. Would you agree that we never felt sort of some obligatory duty in that way?
Yeah. I think I think we try just to well, it was more in the book, maybe. I was trying in the book because the other part of the show was to make the book. And we start early on to work into that because we try to do this chronological book, which is not common to make. It's normally you have a catalog. Normally the catalogs are very clean, very elegant. And I remember I brought this astronomy book, textbook. I got 70s, and all the layout was more, you know, packed with images, small, big, and I think, and I do, I always try, the idea of a big show like that is like try to invite somebody to come into a new world, a universe, or try to navigate into the space of creation of one brain, one person that is traveling around. So I thought it was nice to try to make a kind of astronomical book for the exhibition. And so it was more the chronology on the book.
You're right. In a way, the fact that the book was going to be super historical liberated us in making the show from that responsibility. And I think the book is unusual for a catalog of a contemporary artist, because generally those tend to be a little bit more full of criticism or just kind of essays without attempting a very almost conventional art historical chronicle of the work. And Gabrielle was committed from the beginning to saying, no, treat me as if you would like some, you know, artist from 50 years ago and figure out what I was doing in this year and in that week and in this place. And the way the whole project kicked off was a series of days, of weeks, really, of interviews between Paulina Poboja and Gabrielle, and really just dumping your brain and really, really forcing you to work a lot to say, okay, in 91 I was doing this, in 92 I was doing this. And now that treasure trove of information is there in this book. And I think for me, it's really a model of what a contemporary catalog can be in terms of taking very seriously the job of saying, here's what this guy was doing, not interpreting, not making up anything kind of explanatory, but just saying, here's what happened. Of course, as recounted by him, with a certain amount of fact-checking by us, but...
Oh, well, yeah, very important.
We have yet to find out what of those might be fictions.
I was quite accurate.
I see. Oh, good.
Well, if you were doing that with an artist, like, a bit older, it might be a bit difficult, so I still remember
Your
something.
Memory is still superb, very nice.
Well, you know, it's like not that long ago, so I think it was important to tell this story. I think it's nice to do it now than later, because later I think it's true that we get a bit more, like, We can romanticize our own story maybe a bit more. Or we are so bored with ourselves that we start to trash it, our own story, and trash our old friends because we don't like them anymore. So I still like some people around, so I can talk good about them.
You said some very nice things.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. But also, you know, I'm just thinking about this now, is that it's also very different, the space and time of a book than the space and time in an exhibition. I think, history is not a linear thing. It's more about circularity, cycles. I don't see my work as a process that is a linear process into some kind of progress. And I think I have done different type of work from the beginning, and it's always changing a scale. There is always different techniques, small, big things, ephemeral, and concrete pieces. So I think that the exhibition has another rhythm, another type of space, more into the circulation of a sphere or something. And the book is not. I mean, the book is more like one page after the other, and you have to read it. And I think that's why the chronological aspect of the book makes sense, because the space of the book was that. And also, it was important that the show was traveling to other three venues that are different. So I think, in a way, we have to put together a group of work that will behave differently in every space, and also maybe adding other works, maybe improvising a little bit, so new things. And there are both venues, the venues here, MoMA, and then Kunstmuseum, and then the Pompidou, and then the Tate, are very different. So it's a completely different sense of space and circulation of the work in the show. That's why, to make it chronological, it was, I think, a mistake.
So. But also, it's not a very big space, it seems to me. You had to condense
it's
down.
It's very small. I guess for more space.
I know, unreasonable. Have you made a complaint yet?
I haven't. Because
well, this is your chance. You can formally make this now. Yes, both sides, really.
I have two ways.
What was that Bauhaus? What was it?
What is that, the Bauhaus?
But I'm interested in how, because one of the things I think about your work is that what's very important about it is all those things that seem almost nothing, you know, that seem quite inconsequential, like a drawing that's, I mean, there are some in this show, like that little, is it a pinch drawing? It's almost not there. But all that sort of stuff, not simply pivotal major works, it's this way in which the logic of the work seems to be this kind of chain of associations that can go in all different directions. So how do you think about, you know, salvaging which works, and do you risk losing some of those more unlikely chains of association, do you think? I mean, you have got some of the key pivotal works, haven't you, like the DS and the shoebox, and you must have kind of made a decision to bring those works into some kind of relationship with each other.
Well, curatorially, I think it was very clear to me that the working process of Gabrielle needed to be part of the show. Because so much of what's interesting to me about your work is how it comes to be. And that's not generally something that's available to an audience. But in Gabrielle's case, it is very, I think, important to you that in many ways it's very manifest exactly how something comes to be. And so we took advantage of the show to let that come through very strongly. And I think one of the successes of the show for me is that we took this, what we can inelegantly refer to as a dead-end gallery, and used it to our advantage, because you go into the central part of the show with the dais and the bicycles and recaptured nature, and you have these sort of big public works. And then you go back into the last section of the gallery and you have this sort of private workspace of Gabrielle with things like the working table or with drawings that are just the pinched piece of paper or the object that is just a sock filled with papier-mâché. And after you've been in that atmosphere, you're forced to get, if you want to leave the museum, you're forced to go back through that major part of the exhibition. And what I think is you go through it and come back through it in very different states of mind, having been through the part of the show which is so much more about being intimate with Gabrielle's head and Gabrielle's hand and Gabrielle's fingers. And that kind of reciprocity between those two spaces, for me, was a real joy in being able to create. And so that's not about some kind of, you know, retrospective grouping of here are the most important things, but more like tuning into a way in which somebody can learn the most through maybe not a great number of works, but a way of juxtaposing two different kinds of works that actually end up being the same kind of work in the end.
Hmm. What about you, Gabrielle? Did you think that, in, for example, the working table, does that, is that different? Does it set off different meanings almost in the way it's installed in this show from how you've conceived of it before? I mean, how do you see that, that final room in this?
Yeah, it's a critical space, that one. It's probably the worst space in the museum, that moment. And it's a big door there, and it's a very technically important. There's a lot of circulation. But I think I'm happy with it now. I think we did a good job into making it not a dead end, but more like a round point, like in the streets. Not that much anymore, but you have this area that you can just turn and go back. So I think for me and for us was very important to cut the time of the exhibition. I mean, it's a very long, big, long space, and cut it up in moments that I think start with, obviously in the lobby you have this explosion, and then, You are gonna do the whole? Okay, let's do it. You have with the elevator. Anyway, this is the cover of the book, but then you have at the beginning this kind of explosion and in a lobby and an elevator, and it's a kind of situation that is strange. It's a kind of friendly
off was a series of days, of weeks, really, of interviews between Paulina Poboja and Gabrielle, and really just dumping your brain and really, really forcing you to work a lot to say, okay, in 91, I was doing this. In 92, I was doing this. And now that treasure trove of information is there in this book. And I think for me, it's really a model of what a contemporary catalog can be in terms of taking very seriously the job of saying, here's what this guy was doing, not interpreting, not making up anything kind of explanatory, but just saying, here's what happened. Of course, as recounted by him, with a certain amount of fact-checking by us. But
oh, well, yeah, very important.
We have yet to find out what of those might be fiction.
I was quite accurate.
I see. Oh, good.
Oh, well, if you were doing that with an artist, like, a bit older, it might be a bit difficult, so I still remember
your
something.
Memory is still superb, very nice.
Well, you know, it's, like, not that long ago, so I think it was important to tell this story. I think it's nice to do it now than later, because later I think it's true that we get a bit more, like, we can romanticize our own story maybe a bit more. Or we are so bored with ourselves that we start to trash it, our own story, and trash our old friends because we don't like them anymore. So I still like some people around, so I can talk good about them.
You said some very nice things.
Yeah, thank you. But also, you know, I'm just thinking about this now, is that it's also very different, the space and time of a book than the space and time in an exhibition. I think history is not a linear thing. It's more about circularity, cycles. I don't see my work as a process that is a linear process into some kind of progress. And I think I have done different type of work from the beginning, and it's always changing the scale. There is always different techniques, small, big things, ephemeral, and concrete pieces. So I think that the exhibition has another rhythm, another type of space, more into the circulation of a sphere or something. And the book is not. I mean, the book is more like one page after the other, and you have to read it. And I think that's why the chronological aspect of the book makes sense, because the space of the book was that. And also, it was important that the show was traveling to other three venues that are different. So I think, in a way, we have to put together a group of work that will behave differently in every space. And also maybe adding other works, maybe improvising a little bit, so new things. And is there both venues, I mean, the venues here, MoMA, and then Kunstmuseum, and then the Pompidou, and then the Tate, are very different. So it's a completely different sense of space and circulation of the work in the show. That's why, to make it chronological, it was, I think, a mistake.
So. But also, it's not a very big space, it seems to me. You had to condense
it's
down.
It's very so small. I guess for most, more space. Right?
I know, unreasonable. Very, have you made a complaint yet?
I haven't, because I'm...
Well, this is your chance. You can formally make this now. Yes, both sides, really.
I have two ways.
What was that Bauhaus? What was it?
What is that, the Bauhaus?
But I just... I'm interested in how, because one of the things I think about your work is that what's very important about it is all those things that seem almost nothing, you know, that seem quite inconsequential, like a drawing that's, I mean, there are some in this show, like that little, is it a pinch drawing? It's almost not there. But all that sort of stuff, not simply pivotal major works, it's this way in which the logic of the work seems to be this kind of chain of associations that can go in all different directions. So how do you think about, you know, salvaging which works, and do you risk losing some of those more unlikely chains of association, do you think? I mean, you have got some of the key pivotal works, haven't you, like the DS and the shoebox, and you must have kind of made a decision to bring those works into some kind of relationship with each other.
Well, curatorially, I think it was very clear to me that the working process of Gabrielle needed to be part of the show. Because so much of what's interesting to me about your work is how it comes to be. And that's not generally something that's available to an audience. But in Gabrielle's case, it is very, I think, important to you that in many ways it's very manifest exactly how something comes to be. And so we took advantage of the show to let that come through very strongly. And I think one of the successes of the show for me is that we took this, what we can inelegantly refer to as a dead-end gallery, and used it to our advantage, because you go into the central part of the show with the dais and the bicycles and recaptured nature, and you have these sort of big public works. And then you go back into the last section of the gallery, and you have this sort of private workspace of Gabrielle with things like the working table, or with drawings that are just the pinched piece of paper, or the object that is just a sock filled with papier-mâché. And after you've been in that atmosphere, you're forced to get, if you want to leave the museum, you're forced to go back through that major part of the exhibition. And what I think is you go through it and come back through it in very different states of mind, having been through the part of the show which is so much more about being intimate with Gabriel's head and Gabriel's hand and Gabriel's fingers. And that kind of reciprocity between those two spaces, for me, was a real joy in being able to create. And so that's not about some kind of, you know, retrospective grouping of here are the most important things, but more like tuning into a way in which somebody can learn the most through maybe not a great number of works, but a way of juxtaposing two different kinds of works that actually end up being the same kind of work in the end.
Hmm. What about you, Gabrielle? Did you think that, in, for example, the working table, does that, is that different? Does it set off different meanings almost in the way it's installed in this show from how you've conceived of it before? I mean, how do you see that, that final room in this?
Yeah, it's a critical space, that one. It's probably the worst space in the museum, that moment. And it's a big door there, and it's a very technically important. There's a lot of circulation. But I think I'm happy with it now. I think we did a good job into making it not a dead end, but more like a round point, like in the streets. Not that much anymore, but you have this area that you can just turn and go back. So I think for me and for us was very important to cut the time of the exhibition. I mean, it's a very long, big, long space, and cut it up in moments. In moments that I think start with, obviously in the lobby you have this explosion, and then,
I'm gonna do this for you, hold on.
You are gonna do the whole, okay, let's do. You have with the elevator. Anyway, this is the cover of the book, but then you have in the, at the beginning this kind of explosion, and in a lobby and an elevator, and it's a kind of situation that is strange. It's a kind of friendly.
Off was a series of days, of weeks, really, of interviews between Paulina Poboja and Gabrielle, and really just dumping your brain and really, really forcing you to work a lot to say, okay, in 91 I was doing this, in 92 I was doing this. And now that treasure trove of information is there in this book. And I think for me, it's really a model of what a contemporary catalog can be in terms of taking very seriously the job of saying, here's what this guy was doing, not interpreting, not making up anything kind of explanatory, but just saying, here's what happened. Of course, as recounted by him, with a certain amount of fact-checking by us, but...
Oh, well, yeah, very important.
We have yet to find out what of those might be fictions.
I was quite accurate.
I see. Oh, good.
Oh, well, if you were doing that with an artist, like, a bit older, it might be a bit difficult, so I still remember
Your
something.
Memory is still superb. Very nice.
Well, you know, it's like not that long ago, so I think it was important to tell the story. I think it's nice to do it now than later, because later I think it's true that we get a bit more like... we can romanticize our own story maybe a bit more. Or we are so bored with ourselves that we start to trash it, our own story, and trash our old friends because we don't like them anymore. So I still like some people around, so I can talk good about them.
You said some very nice things.
Yeah, thank you. But also, you know, I'm just thinking about this now, is that it's also very different, the space and time of a book than the space and time in an exhibition. I think... You know, I don't see, history is not a linear thing. It's more about circularity, cycles. I don't see my work as a process that is a linear process into some kind of progress. And I think I have done different type of work from the beginning, and it's always changing a scale. There is always different techniques, small, big things, ephemeral, and... concrete pieces. So I think that the exhibition has another rhythm, another type of space, more into the circulation of a sphere or something. And the book is not. I mean, the book is more like one page after the other, and you have to read it. And I think that's why the chronological aspect of the book makes sense, because the space of the book was that. And also, it was important that the show was traveling to other three venues that are different. So I think in a way, we have to put together a group of work that will behave differently in every space. And also maybe adding other works, maybe improvising a little bit, so new things. And is there both venues, I mean, the venues here, MoMA and then Kunstmuseum and then the Pompidou and then the Tate are very different. So it's a completely different sense of space and circulation of the work in the show. That's why to make it chronological, it was, I think, a mistake.
But also, it's not a very big space, it seems to me. You had to condense
it's
down.
It's very small. I guess for Moss, more space. Right?
I know, unreasonable. Very, have you made a complaint yet?
I haven't. Because I'm.
Well, this is your chance. You can formally make this now. Yes, both sides, really.
I have a two ways.
What was that Bauhaus? What was it?
What is that, the Bauhaus?
But I just, I'm interested in how, because one of the things I think about your work is that what's very important about it is all those things that seem almost nothing, you know, that seem quite inconsequential, like a drawing that's, I mean, there are some in this show, like that little, is it a pinch drawing? It's almost not there. But all that sort of stuff, not simply pivotal major works, it's this way in which the logic of the work seems to be this kind of chain of associations that can go in all different directions. So how do you think about, you know, salvaging which works and do you risk losing some of those more unlikely chains of association, do you think? I mean, you have got some of the key pivotal works, haven't you, like the DS and the shoebox, and you must have kind of made a decision to bring those works into some kind of relationship with each other.
Well, curatorially, I think it was very clear to me that the working process of Gabrielle needed to be part of the show. Because so much of what's interesting to me about your work is how it comes to be. And that's not generally something that's available to an audience. But in Gabrielle's case, it is very, I think, important to you that in many ways it's very manifest exactly how something comes to be. And so we took advantage of the show to let that come through very strongly. And I think one of the successes of the show for me is that we took this, what we can inelegantly refer to as a dead-end gallery, and used it to our advantage, because you go into the central part of the show with the dais and the bicycles and recaptured nature, and you have these sort of big public works. And then you go back into the last section of the gallery and you have this sort of private workspace of Gabrielle with things like the working table or with drawings that are just the pinched piece of paper or the object that is just a sock filled with papier-mâché. And after you've been in that atmosphere, you're forced to get, if you want to leave the museum, you're forced to go back through that major part of the exhibition. And what I think is you go through it and come back through it in very different states of mind, having been through the part of the show which is so much more about being intimate with Gabrielle's head and Gabrielle's hand and Gabrielle's fingers. And that kind of reciprocity between those two spaces for me was a real joy in being able to create. And so that's not about some kind of, you know, retrospective grouping of here are the most important things, but more like tuning into a way in which somebody can learn the most through maybe not a great number of works, but a way of juxtaposing two different kinds of works that actually end up being the same kind of work in the end.
Hmm. What about you, Gabrielle? Did you think that, for example, the working table, is that different does it set off different meanings almost in the way it's installed in this show from how you've conceived of it before? I mean, how do you see that final room in this?
Yeah, it's a critical space, that one. It's probably the worst space in the museum, that moment. And it's a big door there, and it's a very technically important. There's a lot of circulation. But I think I'm happy with it now. I think we did a good job into making it not a dead end, but more like a round point, like in the streets. Not that much anymore, but you have this area that you can just turn and go back. So I think for me and for us was very important to cut the time of the exhibition. I mean, it's a very long, big, long space, and cut it up in moments that I think start with, obviously in the lobby you have this explosion, and then,
I'm gonna do this for you, hold on.
You are gonna do the whole, okay, let's do it. You have with the elevator. Anyway, this is the cover of the book, but then you have at the beginning this kind of explosion, and in a lobby and an elevator, and it's a kind of situation that is strange. It's a kind of friendly.
What does art history do except, save some, leave others behind? So it's almost as if the logic that you set up in the work, that, there's a really, I think, very powerful drive towards waste products and then recycling them and reclaiming them. That's in a way what history does. Rearranging things on a table is not so unlike conceptually rearranging them in your head. And so that was very absolutely part of the thinking of how you can approach objects in a different way. It seems to me important that work of now actually should make us think differently about how we approach writing history rather than just kind of fit into it, be part of what we already know, because obviously the point is we don't already know. So yes, I mean, in that sense, I think it's important.
I think the point you're bringing up also can be extended, of course, within one artist's own work. And one thing I'd like to talk a little bit with you about, Gabrielle, is actually one of the more brand new works in the show, which is this Under the Elephant's Foot, which was just made this past spring. So you see it here on the floor and a detail face on here of the surface of it. And you see it's this cactus that has these artificial eyes inserted all over it. And this, of course, was something which, as always with Gabrielle's work, when we saw it, I and all the other people attending his gallery exhibition in Mexico City in April first looked at it, we were like, oh God, now what?
Why?
And here we go.
Why?
And so, do you want to just talk about the fan? Because like all the other work in the show, this is one object excerpted from a big family. Tell us a little more about that family. This was, of course, a body of work done knowing that this exhibition was coming up soon. And when really you were in full swing working day and night on the checklist with us, on the installation planning, on the catalog, and then you kind of removed yourself to go do this new body of work for the show at Cory Manzuto, and we had no idea what you were doing and why you were taking time off.
Time off to go to work. I don't know. It started a few months before. I was in the beach, and I got this dry cactus leaf, and I like it very much. It was all this membrana with very beautiful structure, looking almost like a coral, and it was a cactus. So I get it to explore more about it, and then I decided to go and collect dry palms and cactus in the desert. So this is from one of those trips, and they die, they just are there. And anyway, I did this exhibition using this recollection of natural objects. And at some point, I just decided to do this insertion of the eyes in the bottom of the palm root. So what you see here is the bottom, what goes into the ground, and you have all these little roots, and the whole thing is like a big sponge. It's quite light. If you touch it, it moves, and it has a nice connection with the foam, the other spumes that are hanging on the counter corner. And the insertion of the eyes, I think it just was a very kind of irrational, funny kind of, you know, just do it. And these eyes are coming from the little shops for religious images and signs and little sculptures. So they sell these little glass eyes in the center of the city in Mexico. And so I thought it was funny to insert it into these weird things. And I felt, of course, very surrealistic when I was doing it, and I don't like surrealism. And I have to say that I even tried to fight it in Mexico, because it's a lot of surrealist painting all the time going on. So and I kind of was very much against that. But there is something about the these connections of things that are, I mean, I connect this work with cats and watermelons in the supermarket, or you can
see the
connect.
Second photo. Oh, we don't have it close up, but the cats on the cat food cans have really big eyes.
And then,
of course, you even have his eyes.
Well, I think this is a different type of thing, but I have this, like, all the plastiline on the collage. It's a kind of collage. But, you know, the idea of the porous, the idea of the receptivity, maybe, in an object, an object that is vulnerable, or an object that is looking at receiving things. So maybe, you know, on the other side was yielding stone, and yielding stone is plasticine, soft, that gets all the imprints from the fingers and all the absorbs the dust. And they look very much alike. They like two bulky things that were in movement and somehow now are just like a piece of stone or something inert. But anyway, I think that sometimes these gestures of metonymy, in which you connect two things that are just apparently there is no relationship, but you see, sometimes we are just in a place next to something, and then just because we are in the same place, we are related to that, whatever it is. So I like this idea of metonymy as a constant activity. It's just that it's happening. So sometimes two things that are related just by contiguity.
Yeah, and you notice it.
You notice it, and you have to notice it, because in fact, all these things that are together, we call it universe, right?
And it's nature's debris, isn't it? It's
nature's debris, yes.
Waste.
Well, just to prove that now there is, like, people believe that Gabrielle will do anything. I read one article somewhere online, or I don't know, in the paper, which actually thought this was a real elephant's foot. Elephant foot is the Mexican colloquial for this kind of cactus. But this author was going on how he found a real foot of an elephant.
Well, huge.
Yeah.
But it also did something to the yogurt pots. It seemed to me that they seem more suddenly like lenses, slightly blind, blank lenses. But I'd never seen them like that. But in conjunction with this, then they take on a very different kind of set of meanings. And a lot of your work seems to be about what it is to look at things, you know, working as looking almost, and then you kind of seize these things out of the generality of things in the world and kind of pick them out and save them in some way and make them, you know, spark off each other. And people have thought that these metonymic chains, contiguities, this is a way of figuring, you know, desire. And I think there is something intensely pleasurable about those kind of chains of association. At the same time, there's something more somber that chips away in your work with the, you know, the destructive or almost the sense of decay or the erosion of things, you know, the disappearance of things.
It's somber. I think it's just that it's movement and it's happening and it's time and things are changing. But I don't see that as a somber, but it's true. There is something about desire in that in the thing that when you are looking for what is happening around, and then you know you get you want to know more. You are curious, and you want to relate with things and get some contact with reality. And I think what I have is a double tendency. In one hand, I am a very abstract kind of person that can be doing these circles or these drawings in a very kind of isolated or abstract situation.
But, you know, what does art history do except, you know, save some, leave others behind? So it's almost as if the logic that you set up in the work that, you know, there's a really, I think, very powerful drive towards waste products and then recycling them and reclaiming them. You know, that's in a way what history does. You know, rearranging things on a table is not so unlike conceptually rearranging them in your head. And so that was very absolutely part of the thinking of how you can approach objects in a different way. It seems to me important that work of now actually should make us think differently about how we approach writing history rather than just kind of fit into it, you know, be part of what we already know, because obviously the point is we don't already know.
Yeah.
So yes, I mean, in that sense, I think it's important.
I think the point you're bringing up also can be extended, of course, within one artist's own work. And one thing I'd like to talk a little bit with you about, Gabrielle, is actually one of the more brand new works in the show, which is this Under the Elephant's Foot, which was just made this past spring. So you see it here on the floor and a detail face on here of the surface of it. And you see it's this cactus that has these artificial eyes inserted all over it. And this, of course, was something which, as always with Gabrielle's work, when we saw it, I and all the other people attending his gallery exhibition in Mexico City in April first looked at it, we were like, oh, God, you know, now what?
Why?
And here we go.
Why?
And so, yeah, do you want to just talk about the fan? Because like all the other work in the show, this is one object excerpted from a big family. Tell us a little more about that family. This was, of course, a body of work done knowing that this exhibition was coming up soon, and when really you were in full swing working day and night on the checklist with us, on the installation planning, on the catalog, and then you kind of removed yourself to go do this new body of work for the show at Cory Manzuto, and we had no idea what you were doing and why you were taking time off.
Time off to go to work. Yeah, well, I don't know. It started a few months before. I was in the beach, and I got this dry cactus leaf, and I like it very much. It was all this membrana with a very beautiful structure, looking almost like a coral, and it was a cactus. So I get it to explore more about it, and then I decided to go and collect dry palms and cactus in the desert. So this is from one of those trips, and they you know, when they die, they just are there. And anyway, I did this exhibition using this recollection of natural objects, and at some point I just decided to do this insertion of the eyes in the bottom of the palm root. So what you see here is the bottom, what goes into the ground, and you have all these little roots, and the whole thing is like a big sponge. It's quite light. If you touch it, it moves, and it has a nice connection with the foam, the other spumes that are hanging on the counter corner. And the insertion of the eyes, I think it just was a very kind of irrational, funny kind of, you know, just do it. And these eyes are coming from the little shops for religious images and signs and little sculptures. So they sell these little glass eyes in the center of the city in Mexico. And so I thought it was funny to insert it into these weird things. And I felt, of course, very surrealistic when I was doing it, and I don't like surrealism. And I have to say that I even tried to fight it in Mexico because it's a lot of surrealist painting all the time going on. So and I kind of was very much against that. And but there is something about the these connections of things that are, I mean, I connect this work with cats and watermelons in the supermarket, or you can
see the
connect.
Second photo. Oh, we don't have it close up, but the cats on the cat food cans have really big eyes.
And then,
of course, you even have his eyes.
Well, I think this is a different type of thing, but I have this, like, all the plastiline on the collage. It's a kind of collage. But, you know, the idea of the porous, the idea of the receptivity, maybe, in an object, an object that is vulnerable or an object that is looking at receiving things. So maybe, you know, on the other side was yielding stone, and yielding stone is plasticine soft that gets all the imprints from the fingers and all the absorbs the dust. And they look very much alike. They like two bulky things that were in movement and somehow now are just like a piece of stone or something inert. But anyway, I think that sometimes these gestures of metonymy in which you connect two things that are just apparently there is no relationship. But you see, sometimes we are just in a place next to something, and then just because we are in the same place, we are related to that, whatever it is. So I like this idea of metonymy as a constant activity. It's just that it's happening. So sometimes two things that are related just by contiguity.
Yeah, and you notice it.
You notice it, and you have to notice it, because in fact, all these things that are together, we call it universe, right?
And it's nature's debris, isn't it? It's
nature's debris, yes.
Waste.
Well, just to prove that now there is, like, people believe that Gabrielle will do anything. I read one article somewhere online, or I don't know, in the paper, which actually thought this was a real elephant's foot. Elephant foot is the Mexican colloquial for this kind of cactus. But this author was going on how he found a real foot of an elephant.
Well, right. Huge.
Yeah.
But it also did something to the yogurt pots. It seemed to me that they seem more suddenly like lenses, slightly blind, blank lenses. But I'd never seen them like that. But in conjunction with this, then they take on a very different kind of set of meanings. And a lot of your work seems to be about what it is to look at things, you know, working as looking almost. And then you kind of seize these things out of the generality of things in the world and kind of pick them out and save them in some way and make them, you know, spark off each other. And people have thought that these metonymic chains, contiguities, this is a way of figuring, you know, desire. And I think there is something intensely pleasurable about those kind of chains of association. At the same time, there's something more somber that chips away in your work with the, you know, the destructive or almost the sense of decay or the erosion of things, you know, the disappearance
of things. I don't
know
if it's somber. I think it's just that it's movement and it's happening and it's time and things are changing. But I don't see that as a somber. But it's true, there is something about desire in that in the thing that when you are looking for what is happening around, and then, you know, you want to know more, you are curious, and you want to relate with things and get some, you know, contact with reality. And I think what I have is a double tendency. On one hand, I am a very abstract kind of person that can be doing these circles or these drawings in a very kind of isolated or abstract situation.
Gabrielle,
the whale.
The whale.
Well, We put a little text accompanying the whale because I think it's important to know that, you know, I went to look for it, to excavate the skeleton in the shores of Baja California. It was a commission for the National Library, a new building that was being constructed, but when they invited me to participate. And the architect is very good. He's a very, probably the most talented architect in Mexico. And it's a great building, I think. So this huge space of the library was quite motivating, I have to say. So when I went there, I have this idea of something floating, like another structure inside that can be just navigating into this huge ocean of shelves and hanging books and all that. So that was the origin of the idea. And then because it's a national protected species, but because it's a commission from the government, we could just go and recover one and then clean it up, put it together, and make this drawing on it.
Just like that?
Just like that. I don't know, of course. A team of six people to look for it in the sand. We localized this specimen that was just two years on the shore, so it still was all together. Like we have to actually take it apart, then consolidate the bones, then make it ready for drawing. Make a big team to make the drawing, put together the structure, and then. I don't know. Maybe this is very technical what I'm saying, but I think it was nice to, as a work, to have all this experience. And at the end, what I'm happy to see it here is that after, you know, I think that it's important for many objects to travel outside their original context because it's a way of exposing the concrete aspect of the work that is not about the anecdote. And not just about the context, but every object can express different things out of this context. So for me, it's important to see the La Dehesa in New York. It's very important to see, you know, the bicycles and all the works that are coming from a very specific context to see it outside in a different moment. So I think that to see the drawing, approximation of to this structure using this drawing that is circles, rings, with the starting point of in the joints of the anatomy of the skeleton. So in a way, the rings are collapsing and expressing the movement or the functionality of this machine in a quiet environment, so you see clearly the drawing with no distraction of the building so much or anything. It was important, so I'm happy. I think it looks fluid drawing. It looks not doesn't look so difficult to make, and which I think is important. And
in fact, I can do a little plug. Gabrielle will be back on this very chair on February 9th. Speaking with the fellow with whom he closely worked to find the whale and get and turn the whale into a work of art and bring it here, and explaining at length the whole planning process and creative process that went into that work, February 9th.
And other works too. Right? It's about the object. Yeah. We're looking for a title, I think. Something like that.
But it is interesting
the object,
that those works that, like the thing you did in Venice as well, where you kind of replicated Carlo Scarpa's sculpture pavilion and then showed it in Madrid in a completely different venue. And it's like a kind of anti-site specificity, you know, which is really interesting, I think, the way it's about how objects change their meaning in different places rather than trying to find some authentic way of documenting things.
And I have to say, I always get a reaction against that. Like, I remember in Madrid was the first time I showed the Scarpa Pavilion outside Venice, and many people thought that was just like a site-specific intervention with this building up this thing in wood, one-to-one replica next door to the original, and in the context of Venice Biennial, et cetera, was a very specific project indeed. But I think then, and I always thought that I wanted to see it outside and see how behave as a sculpture outside, and the people get upset about it. It's like, why? Like, somehow you are corrupting the object. It's like, you know, natives, they have to stay. They don't travel, so or something. I don't know. Then now I'm getting the same with the whale. Some people is like, I think it looks fantastic, but I understand that because I'm not surprised in a way that it's like, why is here? I mean,
I think it's very interesting that I think because artists in the 60s started making works outside the gallery, and this, you know, the rhetoric around site specificity is always an a move against the institution, but there are certain kind of, I don't know, it almost recreates another kind of mode of authenticity, because you're not allowed to speak of things unless they're in their kind of authentic site almost. And so I think it's really interesting that your work kind of moves against that in
interesting ways. Well, I think also that the big jump and the difficult one is how you bring your experience in life and your experiences outside, how you bring them in the museum. You know, I think we can do many things outside and it's all wonderful and it's full of a lot of material and situation. And that's why I don't use video, for example, so much, because I think it's kind of easy. You know, you do something amazing outside, you take a video and then you show the video. But I think it's just, you are not really bringing the phenomena inside the museum, you are bringing the document. Even with photography, I have my, you know, I don't use it so much. I use it when I think there is no other way to bring that experience, to bring that sculptural situation into the museum, or how to transport that into for somebody else to see it. So I think that it happened a lot with many of these, you know, site-specific work that outside, in the only way was through the photo or through the video, or in the books, and that was fine. But when they tried to do it inside the museum, over the years, and looking at it was a little bit hard to enjoy. And I think it's still for me a very important issue, how, if it's possible, to bring in the, how to transport this experience and show them real again.
I remember you once saying that objects erode when they change situation, like a stone or something weathers in the environment, and that, you know, these objects migrating through different contexts is almost like being eroded by the weather. I thought that was a very vivid way of suggesting how things change their meanings in different temporal registers and so on. Are there any other? There's somebody in the front here.
I just wanted to bring up the subject of Cage. He's come up a lot in interviews with you in the past without a lot of elaboration, and tonight you've mentioned him again. Obviously, there's a great sense of temporality, containment of temporality in your work, but I wonder if you could say a little more about how Cage comes into your thinking or has in the past.
Yeah, sure. I think the first time I got involved with Cage, I was in Madrid after finishing school in Mexico. Right after, I moved to Madrid and I did some workshops. I was not doing any postgraduate or anything, but I was, you know, in Madrid and traveling a little bit. And I came out with this very nice book from a musician in Spanish, musician on Cage, a kind of biography, and very, very small book, but really well written. And in the bookshop, I started to read it, and I was like, wow. And then I bought it, and I read this book, and was my companion book for a little while. First of all, the sense of liberation that was for me to read about an artist that the big decision was not to take any decision. I think it's very important, and at some point in life, especially after university and at that age, it's all about decisions. And you have to decide about many things in your life, in your career, about everything, even if about your girlfriend. So that to read that and to see how the discipline to not to take a decision was something of a discipline that you have to prepare yourself so you don't have to judge, you don't have to take any decision and just breathe with life and liberate yourself from the ego that has to decide all the time about everything. So that was already for me like, wow. And, you know, then how do you learn to then be free of taking decisions, and how you learn to go around the world, walking in the street, just looking at everything like you don't have to do anything about it. Just like, but then you need to do about it, because then you are asked to take decisions, and you don't want to take decisions. Maybe you have just to keep going, and your decision is just to keep going. And I think that was the fundamental aspect of Cage. I was not so much interested in the chance systems so much, like how to produce work in relation with chance and chance operations. I have never been so interested in that. But I was interested in the way he was writing and connecting words at the same time in an abstract way, like as objects, as concrete poetry, and as just combination of phenomena. And on the other hand, making sense of what he was writing. So I think the writing became something that I admire and I like, and also liberating, because somehow I like to read, of course, but then there's a point that is boring to read. And when you see Cage, it's like you are not reading, really. You are listening. You are looking at words. You are holding a book and listening to the birds. So the awareness of knowledge in Cage writing is a very three-dimensional in that sense, and is not linear, and is very liberating, even if you're not even paying attention to what you are reading. And so, you know, I don't think that it's so easy to see Cage in the work. I think that because I am not, I don't think I use chance encounters like that. I don't. The operations I use is not the same. But I think that the spirit that he was trying to apply into the work and in the writing and et cetera was very important for me to discover. And especially in Madrid, 80s, after school, very Catholic, postmodernism. Wow, Cage was just like, thank God. I mean, that was really, whew. On the other hand, you have Barcelona. I mean,
I know there were a couple more questions, but we probably should head across the garden for a drink. So those of you who had them, you get to ask Gabriel face to face.
No, that was not in the contract.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.